Chat with Traders, episode 37.
The biggest secret of the best traders in the world is that they're just like everyone else. However, they've worked hard to learn the markets and discover what works and what doesn't. But how can you hear about these journeys and get in on the strategies and tactics they use? You can do it by listening to Chat with Traders. Here's your host, Aaron Fifield.
Hey there, what's up? You're listening to episode 37 of the Chat with Traders podcast. It's great to have you with me, and thank you very much for tuning in. This week, I had the pleasure of speaking to another brilliant trader who has been heavily requested. His name is Morad, but many know him best as Futures Trader 71, or FT for short. To give you just the 30-second rundown, FT has been an active trader since 2000, when he started out scalping NASDAQ stocks. A few years in, he made the transition to trading futures and later started his own proprietary trading firm where he funded and mentored a team of traders. These days, FT runs a brokerage where he provides continuous education and risk control to a structured community, and of course, he remains an active futures trader with a great focus on reading market profile and volume profile, which we get into in great depth during this interview. We also speak about how you yourself can find a statistical edge without the need to be a programmer or have any knowledge in that field. And guys, all the show notes for this episode can be found at chatwithtraders.com/37. So a full recap on this week's episode, any of the links, resources, etc. that are mentioned can all be found there. And just while you're listening, I'd love it if you could please leave a brief review on the podcast in iTunes. This helps in such a huge way to increase the rankings and reach more listeners. So if you could do this, I'd be super grateful. Just go to chatwithtraders.com/iTunes. All right, now for this week's interview, I'm your host, Aaron Fifield, and here is my guest, Futures Trader 71. FT, what's up, man? Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. How are you doing today?
Good, good. Thanks for having me on.
No trouble at all. I mean, I've had many requests to bring you on the show, so it's really great to have you here. Now, let's get this started, like we normally do, by taking it right back to when you first got into markets. So, tell us, how did you first discover trading, and what were you doing prior to this?
Okay, so back in 2000, I was in construction. I was a construction manager. I have a degree in engineering with a minor in economics, and I was working for the largest construction contractor in the U.S. I learned to meditate just a couple years before that. And on a weekend, Memorial Day, a weekend, I believe, in 2000, I went on a retreat. I was living in Florida, drove up to a retreat and a meditation retreat, and I met a guy who was a trader. As we were talking, the markets, the conversation about the markets being as it was 2000, and the crash had just happened, you know, 2 months prior. We were talking about the markets, and he said that he trades equities. He was part of a group known as the SOES Bandits, S-O-E-S. And he, based on our conversation, he said, hey, I think you've got the right personality for this. You should check it out. I guess I'd complained about my job, the hours and the problems with labor and equipment and all that stuff. And he said, you really should look at this. And so I thought, maybe. I was already investing. I was on MotleyFool.com a lot, and I was an IBD subscriber, and I was kind of running some money. I was doing that through college as well. But this was trading, which was a full-time thing. So once the weekend was over, I went back to work, and I requested to have the following Friday off, and I drove from Miami up to a town called Vero Beach, which is just north of West Palm Beach, and basically joined this guy in the morning. And he said, you know, the market opens at 9:30. I trade intensely from 9:30 to about 10:30 or 11. So why don't you come around, 10:45, and I could show you what we're doing as a group, and you can give me your thoughts on it. So I arrived on time. I watched. I sat down quietly. He said, just don't say a word. And it was a room. It was sort of an arcade that he created with a group of people. It was a room full of traders. And for the first time in my life, I see guys with multiple monitors on their desktop and so forth. Remember 2000, that's when LCD started coming out. And it just looked really impressive. And as I sit there, I see this guy just clicking away on his keyboard. And I look at his P&L, and it was like $18,700. And so I thought, maybe that's just his buying power or the account value or something. And then he gets done, and we go out to lunch. And I said, I know this is private, but it says you're up $18,700. Is that a real number? He says, no, that's not. Actually, that's not the correct number. You have to deduct commissions from it. And that blew me away. He said he had traded several million shares that morning to generate that much revenue, and he probably owed about $5,000 in commissions and fees. And it just shocked me to see that he had made in an hour and a half of trading what I would normally make at my normal job over, couple months. And so I was, initially, just like everyone else, I was hooked by the earning potential and so forth. But, as time went on, I learned that that's not what it's about. I basically put in my notice the following week. It took them 2 months to find a replacement for me because I was a project manager, and it would be very difficult to just hand the reins over in a two-week notice on a $40 million project that I was assigned to in Miami. And it took 2 months, and by then I was ready to move. I set up my account, and I basically, that's when I started. So I quit the salaried, regular employment world, and I joined the cowboy world of trading, or that's what it seemed like at the time. So that's how I got my start.
That's an excellent story. So, I mean, that's a pretty bold move to quit your job so quickly, after experiencing what you did. I mean, what was your thoughts behind that? I mean, were you worried that trading was going to be difficult and that you might not pick it up right away? Like, how did you plan on supporting yourself?
So one of the conditions, the guy who introduced me to this is an extremely close friend to this day. One of the conditions was that I would need to read a couple of books before I started. He said, just wait, read the books, don't quit your job, and then decide if this is for you, and then quit your job. I didn't listen to him because, being an arrogant, pup, I knew what I needed to do, and I just quit my job the next week. But, I read The Disciplined Trader by Mark Douglas, and I picked up a couple of other books. And it just seemed to me like I didn't have a choice because I was doing work that I didn't like doing, and I knew I needed to make a change, and I knew that I was in the best position I could be in the business that I was in. I was highly paid for my age. I was one of the highest paid people in my age bracket in a company that's been around for 115 years, a construction company. I was well taken care of. I had stock options, which I cashed to open my account for $50,000. And I was, I had a cushion, and I figured because of the projects that I was on and the tenure that I had, if I spent 2 years and failed at trading, that it wouldn't be an end all for me to get back into the construction business, which is always, there's always work, always something to be built. So to me, it was. And this is the case with my personality and with pretty much everything that I do. It's you're either going to dive in all in or you don't. And so I wasn't going to do that transitional thing where, I'll go to work at 10 a.m. and trade the market from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. type of thing. I was either going to do it and figure out that I'm no good at it, or not do it. And so that it wasn't a big issue for me to quit my job and just pursue it, because I had the means to do that. I had the savings and so on to be able to just leave and go do it. The pain that followed, though, probably, you know, gave me a lot of self-doubt, but it was definitely worth it.
Sure. Okay. Well, let's get into that pain and self-doubt. So you've quit your job. What was the next step from there? Like, what was your experience like for the early years?
This is going to sound all too familiar probably to your audience, but basically I had the best possible environment to become a trader. And I've always traded in a professional environment. So I was surrounded by guys who, I'll give you an example. The last guy before me who joined this group, on his best day, he made over $90,000 in one day. The guy who brought me into the group, his best day was $280,000 in one day. I was in good hands. But in trading, being in good hands it helps. You know, I was in a room that was very focused. There were blinds on the windows, even though we're in sunny Florida. There was a news feed that was running all day long. There was an S&P pit squawk that was running all day long. There was multiple LCDs with CNBC and Bloomberg on them. There's a Bloomberg terminal. It's just, and I was with these traders that just came in and absolutely obliterated the market every day, it seemed. But that's not enough. That's not enough, because coming in, you know, watching someone trade, it's kind of like watching a Federer play tennis. It just looks so easy, you know. Oh, he just has to run and hit the ball. That's all he's got to do. But try returning a serve from a professional tennis player. You know, good luck with that. So over the next few months, I basically discovered that I neither had the right attitude, nor did I know myself enough. And that's the hard part, to be able to extract any sort of profits out of the market. So I opened a $50,000 account, and I traded equities. I started with the slower products, Dell, JDSU, and so forth. This was NASDAQ equities. And, you know, the idea was to trade a 50-share lot and to make, you know, $20, $30 a day at the beginning, and then to increase your size and so forth. I basically did not make money for the first, I think it was about 3 months. I just consistently lost every day. And this is trading from, you know, the time the market opens till the time it closes. So it's pretty intense to sit there all day just fearful that you might hit the wrong key on the keyboard and do something that would, you know, destroy your account. In the meantime, I heard guys yelling, breaking keyboards, rejoicing for the profits that they just made, or there was a lot of input. And this contrast this with some of the folks that I know now who trade online, who are sitting in their basement, you know, in a quiet environment. Maybe they're a part of a chat room and it's just a very sterile sort of environment where you're not getting all that feedback. The room I was in, you know, people would yell out things all the time. You know, the bid's thickening up on, you know, Cisco. Take a look at Cisco. Or I'm getting short 20,000 shares here. Looks like the offer's not moving down. I'm out. I'm scratching this trade. Damn it. You know, that sort of stuff. These guys are just constantly talking. And I was the guy in the corner with one monitor, you know, because that's all I could afford at the time. And just sitting there and trying to figure out, what are they talking about? What is an offer? You know, what is a bid? Why are they hitting the bid but not hitting the offer? Why are they lifting the offer? What does that mean? How do you read this scrolling tape that's going up my screen? You know, what is this? What are all these blinking lights and numbers? It took a while. It was just like you're just basically being thrown into the middle of a a lake and said, told to swim. There was no training or anything because we were all independent. There was no, this was not a prop shop, but it was a professional environment. You know, people wanted to help out when they could, and that's a huge edge. And then finally I started to get it. You know, I started to understand that maybe I should be buying when I feel like selling. You know, maybe I should wait for the market to tell me what it wants before I do anything, as opposed to just getting in there and saying, oh, what the heck, it looks like it's going to go up. Boop. Nope, it went down. So that was the pain, just coming home every day and basically seeing that some of the guys were leaving with $5,000, $6,000, $10,000, $20,000 winning days. And I'm just losing $500 a day, and I'm watching my account go from 50,000 to, you know, 20,000 to 40,000 to 35,000 to 32,000 to 28,000. And it just seemed like there was no end in sight. And the more pain, the more fear there was, and the more hesitation there was, and the more losses there were. It's just the cycle that somehow had to be broken. And all you could do about it is just show up, turn on your monitor, sit down, watch the market. It's all you could do. Just sit there. I read a bunch of books and all that stuff, and it all sounds great when you're reading a book. Oh, okay, yeah. So all I have to do is be aware of my fear. Or all I have to do is look at this moving average. Nonsense. You just have to reprogram your instincts, because we were trading order flow and we were doing it in high volume and high speed manually, and you just had to be in the flow of the market. It's much like, you know, surfing. You can talk about when you should jump on your board and when you should paddle and what part of the wave you should be in and how to ride a wave. You could talk about it all day long, but unless you're out in the ocean floating around waiting for the next wave and falling off your board with every wave and learning, you know, muscle memory and teaching yourself that, you're not going to make it. And you certainly can't learn to surf while you're sitting on Lake Michigan in Chicago, you know, where there are no waves. You had to be in the middle of where everybody else is, and I was, and that's the saving grace. I think that's the key element that helped me see that there is, yes, you can do this for a career, because there are people there. I had that hope, you know, and I didn't need that much hope because I could see that these guys were making money. It can be done. It's me. Something's wrong with me. It's not the market. It's not my equipment. It's nothing. It's my head. And that made the transition or the turn come a lot sooner, because I had continuous evidence that this can be done, whether it's a slow day or a trend day or a fast day. It didn't matter. Somebody somewhere was making money, and somebody somewhere was losing money as well. I was one of the folks losing money. I hope that answers your question.
Absolutely. No, that was an awesome answer. So would you say that after those initial 3 months of trading, did you start to gain some consistency, or how long did it take you before you were consistently profitable as such?
So I will define consistently profitable not as a dollar amount or metric. I will define it because I had to actually learn to trade twice in my career. Three times, actually. One as a SOS equity bandit, as a SOS scalper, when they had fractions and then moved to decimals. Then I had to relearn to become a trader when I moved to Chicago and started trading futures, which is what I trade now, as an order flow, high volume scalper, meaning, you know, regularly trading 3,000 round turns a day, something in that volume. And then I had to relearn to trade the market the way I do now, which is more structure, more a stronger position, and more methodical, slower. And I could tell you that consistency should be defined, in my opinion, as the ability to confidently come in and say, yeah, I'll take something out of this market, as opposed to, oh yeah, I'll make $1,000 a day. I'm a consistent trader. No, consistency is when you don't know what the market's going to hand to you for the day. It could be $50, it could be $15,000. Consistency is the ability or the confidence to come in and say, yes, I am confident that I'll do what I'm supposed to do, and that I'll walk away, and I'll be rewarded for that. And I would say it took 3 months during my equity days, like my first exposure to trading, took 3 months for me to stop bleeding. It took about a month of me just floating around, making a little bit and losing a little bit. And then something happened about the fifth or so month where I could confidently come in and say, yeah, I'm okay making $100 today. I think I could do it. I think I'll have at least a couple of opportunities to do that today. And that was, you know, around the fifth, sixth month. And then once you're there and you string together a bunch of days where you confidently put up money, amazing things happen in that you become a lot less fearful with sufficient respect to risk in order to be reasonable with your losses. And then, you know, there's a day where you hit $600. You're just in the flow that day. Things just seem to happen. It's hard to describe. And then for the next couple of days, you may not make much money at all, maybe flat or lose some money. And then one day you come in and, oh, wow, this is my best day ever. I made $1,200. And all of a sudden, it's almost like a chart, you know, a trend where you have a trend, you have a breakout, then you have a small pullback, and then you have another breakout, continuation move, and you have a pullback. That's how it was. And then as you get more and more confident, you get to the point where you think, well, I'm trading 1,000 share lots. Let me put on a 10,000 share trade. What difference does it make? You do that, and then you lose your whole month. And unfortunately, most traders have to go through that several times before they truly become consistent in that you just understand that it can bite your head off at any moment, you know, kind of like being an alligator handler. Yes, you can get it to, you know, hold its mouth open and so on. But if you lose awareness of that, where that alligator is, it'll bite your leg off. You know, you need to you can gain confidence, but you should always have a healthy respect for the nature of the market, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. No, that's really good. I like the way you described consistency there. I think that's really on point. Now let's dig into how you're actually trading today in current times. So would you mind giving us just an overview of your approach to trading?
Okay, so just a little bit of background. Once I stopped trading equities and I moved to futures and moved to Chicago from Florida, I basically traded order flow. I basically traded momentum. All we did was watch multiple markets and you try to be the first. Like if the S&P starts moving up and the Dow is lagging, then you'd buy a bunch of Dow and you would wait for it to catch up to the S&P and so on and so forth. There was no technical analysis involved at all, even though, you know, we paid for very expensive charting packages and things like that. I did that for a prop shop, which is a proprietary trading shop, means there's a company that puts up who owns the account, puts up the risk capital. You come and trade it, and you get a payout, a split of whatever profit you make, and they carry all the risk, and they charge you for things like rental of a desk and the cost of a computer and a phone line and so on. And so I did that for a while, and then I went and I left that business, and I actually created my own prop shop. And I started to back people and train people and so forth. I was training people. I was training new traders while I was at the first prop shop. After I became profitable again in futures, And when I trained people, I would get a cut of their profits. I would share the house's cut of the profits. So I got to see how people go through the process of learning what issues there are. I got to work with a couple of floor traders who were transitioning to the screen, who are by far the worst guys that I've ever tried to work with, going from trading, 100 lot S&P in the pit, which is, $500 or $250 a point, and then telling them to trade one lots in the S&P E-minis doesn't go well with these guys. So I learned a lot about psychology, the psychology within others. And in teaching others, I could see within myself what I needed to do, what I needed to work on. And then once I started my prop shop and got that going, it was very successful. I backed about a dozen people on my own. Over time, I could see that the markets were paying less for more risk. So after 2005, 2006, the scalping algos, predatory algos, and things like that started to come into effect, and co-locating and high-speed execution and high-speed order flow started to eat into my bottom line. And so I started to cut back on, or I stopped backing newer people, and I just let my current traders just run out their contracts. And it just seemed like they're always asking for more and more buying power for the same returns or less. And I didn't like that at all. So I started to look around educate myself about different ways to trade. I could not compete with the computers at a microsecond level. But what I could do is increase my time frame and potentially catch bigger moves. And that transition is extremely difficult to make when you go from clicking away all day long on the mouse and trading 2,000, 3,000 round turns in a day to, putting on a position and taking a bunch of heat, meaning letting the position go against you for a while and waiting for it to turn. That whole, it was like trying to turn a sprinter into a marathon runner. It required a whole different group of muscles and a whole recalibration of my mind. So that was my third learning phase. So as I developed that, I went from just trading order flow on the depth of market to studying every indicator and every little thing that existed. I would recreate RSIs on a spreadsheet. I would create these dynamically linked spreadsheets that give me the same information that's on the chart so that I could understand what the chart, how the line on the chart's being created. How is an exponential moving average different than a simple moving average? Things like that. So I started to look into that, and I wasted a lot of time looking at these lagging indicators. And eventually I came across Market Profile, which made a lot of sense. I'm a member of the CME, and the CME was pushing Market Profile as a there was a free course on it. And actually Dan Gramza, which is maybe someone you've interviewed, was offering a course on market profiling. So it was free to exchange members. So I went and I started to dig into that and I started to study it, and it made sense to me how we're organizing the information based on 30-minute time slots into a statistical histogram. So we can see where the market traded a lot, what prices it accepted versus what prices it rejected. I did that for a while. I basically became an expert in market profiling, and I started to use that as a basis. But over time, and having a very expensive charting package, a $900 a month CQG integrated charting, there was a feature in there that would allow me to not only look at a market profile, but to actually look at the volume at every price to create this volume profile. But nobody was using that. Nobody knew anything about it. And it just made more sense to me that, wait, why do I care about time? I should care more about how much traded at every price. So I started to do studies using Excel and so forth, into volume profiling. And I just started to develop this approach of looking at volume at each price versus volume at each bar, and understanding how the auction is working. If the key participants in the market feel that a certain price is fair, or there's nothing more to, there's no reason to move price away from an area, then it would trade a lot in that area, and it would create this very bulgy profile in that price range. And what that clearly showed me is that, okay, it's got nothing to price, but people still are trading. And for every contract that's bought in futures, another contract is sold. There's never an occasion in the market where there are more buyers and sellers. That does not exist. There are more aggressive buyers than sellers. But for every contract that's bought, there's a contract that's sold. And if the market's trading in this tight range and it's got a ton of volume in that range, and for every buyer there's a seller, then what that means is if the market starts to move away from this area that's been accepted, then half of the volume that went into that creating that bulge is wrong, and they're going to have to cover their positions. It's going to trigger some stops, and they're going to have to cover their positions. And so I would observe that over the next few days. I would look at, okay, if the market's in the tight range because they're expecting news, or there's nothing, you know, it's dead and there's nothing further to do, what happens when we break away from that? What happens when we break away and we pull back? Where does it pull back? How much of a pullback do we get? So I started to do this scientific engineering kind of approach to looking at what the market's doing in the form of an auction. And that's how I trade. The folks who suggested that you reach out to me and to have this conversation with you, I appreciate it, by the way. Those folks are followers on Twitter because of this approach, because this is all I talk about and it's all I do, and I've not changed it since 2005 or 6, and it's the same thing, and it's what drives the market. So you can sit there and impose VWAPs and CCIs, and you can put all kinds of indicators on the market, but the bottom line is, what price did they trade and how much trading occurred there? That's what governs. And so you can express that in all kinds of different mathematical ways, which is fine. I'm not poo-pooing that. I think that's – you use whatever you feel you need to in order for it to make sense, because ultimately it's your money that's at stake. But to me, understanding how the market goes from – an area of acceptance to another area of acceptance to another area of acceptance. That's very important. And we see it in everyday life. We see it with the most valuable things that we buy on a regular basis. Think of when we look at retail, it's a one-way market. There's usually one seller. You know, we show up at the supermarket to buy milk. You're only buying milk from that retailer. You can't go somewhere where you're able to buy milk from many different retailers all at the same time. So it doesn't represent what the market, what we see in the market every day. But it's very similar. If milk is something you consume every day, and let's say a liter of milk is $1.50, and that's what you commonly pay for it. That's value. So if I charted the number of units of milk that have been sold at $1.50, I would end up with a very long line. And then I could go to a convenience corner store, which is going to charge you a premium for that convenience. They may sell that same carton of milk, liter of milk, for $2. But they will sell much fewer units because people know that they can go buy it for $1.50. So that's the high end of value. And But there are days that, you know, you can join a price club like Costco or Sam's Club here in the U.S. where you can buy things at wholesale rates. So I can go and buy, instead of a liter of milk, I can buy 10 liters of milk at 90 cents. And so so that becomes the lower extreme of what a liter of milk should cost. But let's say you're dependent on buying this milk for $1.50, and all of a sudden there's a mad cow disease, and there's a shortage of milk, and all of a sudden everybody's selling milk for $2.50. And now, over time, as more and more people buy that milk because they don't have a choice, now you have value moving from $1.50 to $2.50. And it stays there. The fact is, you're going to buy less of it. You're going to try to find alternatives, maybe water it down or something. You're going to buy less of it because the market is much higher in value. As soon as this issue that caused milk to get more expensive goes away, then you immediately, as a naturally, as a human being, remember that the market was at $1.50. for a liter of milk. And so your expectation is, as prices drop, they will likely continue to drop until it goes back to $1.50. To me, that represents a short trade opportunity from a temporary high price back to the most accepted price, which is the point of what's called the point of control. And the market does this all day, every day, except it doesn't have one value point like the price of milk does. That's just a simple example. It creates value every day. Every day it picks an area where it trades a lot, and then it moves away and it picks another area. But if it does not hold that higher area, the most likely thing it'll do is it'll move back to the prior value area. If it cannot hold that value area and it continues, look for a lower value area, and so on and so on and so forth. So I'm watching volume of price. I'm watching the quality of the rotations. In other words, how quickly did price move from one area to the next? How desperate were the participants in that area? Is it done moving to that next area, or is there more liquidity available that's going to prevent it from waiting there and it's going to push it lower? And there are ways to detect that. And I talk about those every day. I mean, I opened up How I Trade to the public back in 2009 as a way of giving back. And it's not a system. So it's not something where I'm concerned that my edge is going to disappear over time. Most people who've watched me talk about this stuff since 2009 will attest to the fact that it has not changed in that long. And on a day-to-day basis, I show up at 8 a.m. Chicago time, 9 a.m. Eastern, before the market opens a half hour, and I sit there and I say, here's what we said it would do yesterday. Here's what it did. Here's why it did or did not work. Here's what was set up yesterday. Here's what set up overnight. Here's what I expect to happen today. And here are my key trades for the day. And then the next day I look back and I say, here's what I said it's going to do. And I repeat it. And I call those trader bites. And I post those every day and are done live on YouTube as a way to demonstrate to other traders that they don't need to go out and pay for some ridiculously expensive course or be part of some crazy chat room or signal service, that they can do this on their own. And that's really an important factor for me. I've done well with trading, and I have something that explains the market at its core. And you can throw your moving averages on there, fibs or Drummond geometry or Gartley patterns or whatever you want to use. It's okay. Use what may own it. Ultimately, you have to own what you're doing. But first and foremost, understand what makes the market move and how it moves, what causes these rotations. And it's all about price discovery. The market's job is not to run stops and make everyone lose money and give it all to the big houses, the Goldman Sachs's and the JP Morgans of the world. They're in the same situation as everybody else.
the market's main purpose is to get as many buyers and sellers to meet and agree on price as possible. The market's mechanism, key mechanism, is to discover value, because that's where the most trading will happen. Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah, no, I really appreciate you going to such great lengths with that answer. That's really, really good. And just so we're clear, so we've just discussed their market profile and volume profile. Obviously, volume profile is, how we describe this, kind of like the horizontal bars that go up the vertical axis of your chart.
Yep.
How is market profile plotted on a chart?
Market profile is plotted on a chart the same way, but instead of using, I use tick volume. So it's taking every single tick that trades and is organizing it at every price level. Market profile just basically takes half-hour slots and creates either a dot or a letter and then organizes that dot or letter the same way. So where volume profiling is representing the exact volume, hopefully if you have a good enough data feed and a strong enough charting package, it should represent the exact volume that occurred at any given price. Market profile is only looking at time. So a market profile where the market traded a lot of volume within a certain range is going to look exactly the same as a market profile chart where the market just traded very little volume but continued to trade that same range. It'll basically show the exact same thing. But to me, that doesn't represent the same information. If I'm able to represent volume at price, it's a true indication of how motivated the different traders are at trading at those prices. To me, time should not be – I don't like time being a factor in my trading. I'm not interested in 15-minute bars or 5-minute bars or 3-minute bars. I remember when I was researching, moving away from tick scalping to trading, you know, more technically, I would hear things like, yeah, you know, what I look for is for the 5-minute bar to close below the 20-period moving average. And it just seemed to me, it just didn't make sense to me personally. It may make sense to others. It just didn't make sense to me personally why it should be a 5-minute bar that has to close under the 20-period average. Why not 6 minutes? Why not 3? Why not 10? Why not 12? Why not some random number? It just did not make sense to me, because I felt like, you know, does it make a difference to the merchant whether you buy that milk between 8 and 8:32 a.m. versus 9 and 9:02 a.m.? It doesn't matter. You're still buying a certain volume of milk, and you're buying it at a certain price. And that's what determines, you know, whether or not that merchant should restock its shelves, or if the milk is just sitting there rotting. It doesn't matter how much time there is. Well, in the example of milk, that doesn't apply because the stuff rots. But does that make sense? So that's the difference between I felt like market profile was great back in the day when you didn't have all this volume information. But these days, I get tick volume, and I have that information. So why would I be stuck organizing the market in terms of time when I can organize it in terms of price and volume?
Yeah, I think that's a really fair point. And I like the milk analogy too. I think that helps to make things a little bit clearer. And what I'll do is I'll actually link to your YouTube channel, so people who are interested in finding out more about this can go there and check it out. So a link to your YouTube channel will be in the show notes at chatwithtraders.com/37. So I recommend you know, anyone who wants to find out more, definitely check that out. Now, I've got another question around market and volume profile. So you're using them sort of intraday for intraday trades. Can they provide benefit to traders who may not operate on an intraday time frame, such as swing traders and position traders, etc.? Or do they tend to become less effective as you zoom out by time frame?
Great question.
I'll let you in on a secret. In my own portfolio, for my own investments, I use volume profiling. For example, you can do a volume profile on Apple and look at Apple over, you know, how has it traded since it split, and look at how much volume, how many shares are traded at every price, and you can get the exact same information. I organize things by day because I trade in a day time frame. I hardly carry any positions past the close. Prefer to, it's just not my style. In fact, the fact that I trade, can hold a trade for several hours during the day is a huge leap from the few seconds I used to hold trades. But it's the same thing that applies. In my own investments, the way I determine, like if I was to trade an option, for example, if I held shares of, say, Potash, and I wanted to, let's say I owned 100 shares of Potash and I wanted to generate additional revenue, I could sell an option, a call option against that position, collect the premium. And the way I would decide what the price of that option should be, what the strike price of that option would be, is to look at a profile that carries for more than a day. And it's very easy to do that. If someone goes to my website, for example, futurestrader71.com, and looks at some of the images that I have in there, they'll see that there's what I call a composite profile. And this is a profile that's collecting data at every price over years. And it shows you over the last couple of years where the market has traded a lot versus where the market has rejected prices. So it's the same process. By the same token, on very slow days when the market tends to be locked into a range, what I do is I look at 5-minute profiles, so not really 5-minute, but I basically have the software draw a profile every time it trades 10,000 shares. So I look at these mini profiles. I call them intra profiles. They're like within each bar, I can see a profile of the bar. So I can see, you know, when you look at a candlestick, let's say you're looking at a 15-minute candlestick. That candlestick is showing you where that candlestick opened, how far it went down with a wick, and then it shows you how far it went up with a wick, and it shows you where it closed, right? That's all the information you're getting out of a candlestick. If you attach a volume histogram at the bottom, you can also find out how many shares or contracts traded within that candlestick. But what you don't know, what you're blind to, is where that volume occurred within those prices. So if Apple moved $5 in a 15-minute candlestick, you don't know if the volume occurred at the bottom of the candlestick where most of that trading occurred, or did it occur evenly distributed within a candlestick, or did it occur at the top part of the candlestick? That's important information, because if it occurred at the top part of the candlestick and the close of that candlestick was below that high volume area at the top, that shows weakness. It shows that as the market tried to push higher in this 15-minute bar, that there was a supply, there was liquidity there. And it continued to trade and trade and trade, and the traders failed within that candlestick to overcome that liquidity. If I was holding a long position, I would start to consider, I should lighten up here. I should take some profits and reduce my risk. So it does apply to pretty much any time frame. I use it for – I look at weekly profiles. I look at monthly profiles, and I also look at – a few seconds worth of profiles, because all I'm looking for is just detail within a time period of where the volume has occurred, where the trading has occurred. And that gives me a lot of information.
Okay. No, that's a brilliant answer. Thank you very much. Now, let's keep this moving a little bit. So I know you have a very specific way of determining what defines a setup and what actually defines an edge. So would you be able to share with us how you define these two commonly used terms, like what is an edge and what is a setup in your eyes?
So an edge, to me, an edge is simply a probability of one thing happening over another. So an edge is as simple as, look, the market has sold off for the last 4 days. And I do a lot of statistical study because I think that's the missing link for a lot of traders, is that they just want to follow a head and shoulder pattern or cup and handle or whatever. But they don't have they haven't built the confidence or the background of how often something works. But I think in probabilities. The times when I didn't think in probabilities, I was probably thinking emotionally, because I think that's the alternative. That's the only other alternative there is. And emotional trading leads to losses. An edge is as simple as, look, if the market's been selling off for 4 days, in other words, it's made lower lows for the last 4 days, let me look at statistically over the last 3,000 days, how often has the fifth day been a selling day? And if I look back, given any stock or any commodity, if I look back and I see that the probability, the number of times that after 4 days of selling, that the fifth day was a selling day, has occurred just 1.5% of the time, then the next day, I'm not going to look for selling opportunities. I'm not going to be aggressive about the selling. I may still sell, but I'm not going to be aggressive with the selling. That's an edge. Something as simple as that is an edge. I know the probability of today making a lower low is 1.5% given a large sample, 3,000 trading days. So if the market gets close to the low and I can see an opportunity where I can get in and my reward, my upside, is much better than the loss, which could be the prior day's low, that would be my stop out, somewhere beneath that would be my stop out point, then that's a huge edge. And all I have to do is just put that on whenever it shows up, indiscriminately. Another way to describe an edge, and the description of an edge is very simple. It is the probability of one thing happening over another that provides you a one-to-one or higher reward to risk, period. Over a period of time, that concept alone should show you profit, you know, given that you overcome your costs, your commissions and fees and so on. That's all you need for an edge. A lot of people, when they talk about edge, and I read a lot, I look at forums a lot, I've done a lot of talks on several forums with regards to different ways. I'll give you a simple edge. I trade the S&P 500 futures, the minis. Statistically, and I have a video on this on YouTube, you just have to look it up. Just look up Futures Trader 71 statistical edge or something, statistical analysis. And I show how I extracted this study using Excel, very simple study, where I showed that 97% of the time, given 1,700 days of a sample, 97% of the time, the S&P 500 will either touch or break the overnight high or the overnight low in that session. So the market opens at 9:30 Eastern. 9:30 Eastern till 4:15 Eastern is considered RTH. That's the regular trading hours. That's what we call the pit session. If I look at that session, 97% of the time, the high or the low of that session should have touched or exceeded the high or the low of the overnight session or the Globex session. Does that make sense or is that complicated?
No, that's good. That's good. I like where you're going with this.
So that's an edge, 97%. So the only thing I have left to do now is figure out where can I, given where the market is opening today and knowing that the overnight high, let's say the overnight high is 1932 in the S&P and the overnight low is 1914, the market looks like it's opening around 1920. All I have to do is figure out, okay, who's dominating the auction at the beginning? Is it the sellers that are in control? Because if the sellers are in control, I'm going to target that 1914 low, the overnight low, and there's a 97% probability that the low or the high is going to be tagged or touched today. And so if I'm trading with the dominant side and sellers look like they're in control, in other words, the market drops quickly and then moves up extremely slowly and laboriously, that I'm going to try to get short somewhere where I can define my risk. And that's a very fluid decision. The context of it is very fluid. I would have to have a screen in front of me to describe that. But I talk about that all the time. I've eliminated, I would say, 80% of the decision-making process on the spot as I trade. I've eliminated it by identifying that simple edge. My job now is to find an area to get short, period. In the example of four selling days with the fifth day having only a 1.5% probability of making a lower low, I have already eliminated most of the work. I am going to look to push my long trades today versus my short trades. I'm going to be tentative with my short trades, meaning I'm going to have very small targets. I'm going to trade them with 1/4 of the unit size. But my long trades are going to be the bulk of my focus today. That in itself, identifying that small piece of information, puts me ahead of a huge number of traders who have no idea what could happen today statistically. And I have the data to back it up. And everybody's got the same data. I'm just digging into it and creating a probability out of it. So that's an edge. As far as a setup, that's another thing that's very fluid. If I could describe what I'm doing in the form of if-then-else statements, Aaron, I would not be sitting at my desk every day. I would hire a programmer, I would go on Elance, hire a programmer, create a system, and just invest money in it and, just let it rip all day long. But that's not how I trade. That's not who I am. My setups are dependent on my edge. My setups are mainly built on the price action, the current price action versus what the context of the auction is. In other words, what is the volume profile telling me? Who is the dominant force? The best example of how I trade, best analogy would be if you were in a bar brawl. You're in a bar. Suddenly a fight takes place. You can't leave. You're going to be a part of this fight. Where most traders just are like, well, I'm here to brawl, so I'm just going to start punching somebody. And so they're very impulsive. And remember, I'm part of a brokerage now. I started a brokerage several years ago that takes my prop experience and brings it into a brokerage setting. It's called Stage 5 Trading. And I've watched how retail traders or online traders trade. And the analogy that comes to mind is they come in, sleeves rolled up. They know they're going to have to throw a punch today. Even if they don't have an advantage, even if the guy they're about to punch is 300 pounds and has 2% fat, they'll throw a punch. That's not smart. My approach is to wait, find out who's throwing the better punches and who's got the better fighters, and to go and fight on that side. That's my approach. I want to identify through my volume profile, through the detecting how the market is rotating. In other words, from the swing high to the swing low of the last few bars, which side tends to gain more ground with every push. And then what I do is I trade with that side. So I wait. I generally don't throw a trade out there right at the market open. There's no edge for me. I still don't have enough information. I want to know who is the gorilla, the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and who's controlling the auction, if there is anybody, and to trade from that side. If the 800-pound gorilla in the room doesn't show up, in other words, there isn't an immediate push and control from the buyers or sellers, and it just seems to float around kind of like yesterday's market did when it opened, then I know that I'm going to be trading against short-term traders. I'm going to be trading against scalpers and short-term position traders. And if I'm trading against those people, those are the dominant participant in the market, then we're going to be basically playing whack-a-mole with price. We're going to be beating each other over the head. And so I'm going to trade with the expectation that my targets have to be very short-ranged, and that there's going to be a lot of fluff. There's going to be a lot of back and forth that is kind of pointless until somebody comes in, a higher time frame, somebody with some real business to transact comes in, pushes the market in one direction, at which point I'll probably take a loss, but then it immediately gives me an opportunity to go with that participant. It's very technical, but it's hard to describe in words. It's much easier to describe on a screen, of course.
Of course, yeah. So we'll definitely link to your YouTube channel in the show notes. Just before we move on, though, I'd just like to ask you another question on your answer there. Do you still do all your studies in Excel, or do you use more advanced software for some of your other setups and when you're looking for an edge?
So because I'm trading in a more traditional way, it's sufficient for me to use Excel, and because I'm an expert at Excel, it's easy for me to manipulate the data using filters and so on to get what I want. However, there are studies that cannot be done in Excel. And so what I do is I've looked at, several statistical packages like JMP or R, I'm not a coder, and I just don't have the time running a brokerage and doing this education stuff plus running a charity. I just don't, and being a father, I just don't have the time to sit here and learn to code. But the software that I use, it's called InvestorRT by Linsoft.com. The software I use has made a lot of advances, and I've worked very closely with the developers, has made a lot of advances in that I'm able to extract more complex data very, very quickly with it. And luckily, because I have such a close relationship with them, if it's too complex for me, I just call them up and I say, hey, how often does ABC happen when, DEF happens, and I get the results that I want. The proper way to do that, if I was to operate like more of like an institution, is to have someone who's just sitting there cranking out studies all day long. But frankly, I'm just a trader. I am not interested in dissecting the market in 50 different ways and to know to the tick and to the fifth decimal place how often some probability occurs. I feel like I'm at risk of, because I'm an engineer by nature, I'm at risk of getting lost in all of the numbers. And I've done that to myself. I start a spreadsheet and I'm looking for one thing and I end up spending 6 hours extracting so much stuff that really, but I still haven't answered the initial question that I set out to do. What I do with trading is keep it simple. The banner for my site says simplicity in trading. Trading is simple. It's not easy. It's not easy, but it's simple. And I found the more complex I make it, whether it's by, statistical studies or I start to play with some indicator or create some sophisticated system, and I've worked on trading systems in the past, I find that it loses something. And one of the key things it loses is expected value or expectancy or return on capital. The more complex I make something, the less I get out of it. So in general, I look for simple things. Let me ask you, what is your favorite instrument that you trade, Aaron?
That would be U.S. equities.
U.S. equities. Throw one out.
Goldman Sachs.
Goldman Sachs. Okay. So if you look at Goldman Sachs, one of the things I would look at is what is the magnitude of movement per unit of earnings per share release, beat or miss? How far, if they come out with their earnings and they always beat their earnings expectation and guidance, how far should I expect the market to move? That's number one. The second is, this is an earnings season play. So I get to play it four times a year. The second thing is, when it gaps, how often does it move back to where it was the night before the earnings release, the day before the earnings, and how often does it actually move away from that price? I want to know, does it generally return back, let's say, I don't know, what is Goldman trading at these days? I have no idea. But let's say it's, let's throw a number, $40. And then earnings come out, they beat as usual, and it gaps up and it's at $45 the next morning before the open. I think they announce it like 6 a.m. Chicago time before the open. And let's say it jumps up to $45. The question I would have is, okay, how often does it go back to $40? How often does it retest the last most accepted price before that earnings announcement? That's number one. Number two, in how many days does it take? Does it do it the next session? Does it do it in three sessions on average or what? And that creates a position trade or a swing trade edge potentially for me. It also creates an option trade edge for me. So I keep it simple. That sort of question can be answered with just a pen and paper pad or an Excel sheet. You know, there's no need to pull in tick data and use R to get statistics and correlations on that sort of study. That's the sort of thing that I prefer to trade, something that is created on the actual market movement or the actual market process rather than something that's purely mathematical. It has to make sense to me from the perspective of buyers and sellers coming to trade versus what does it do mathematically. That's why I don't use floor pivots, floor pivot numbers and so on, or Fibonacci retracements or anything like that. I need to understand how this makes sense from the perspective of someone who thinks the product is, you know, Goldman Sachs is too expensive, or who thinks it's too cheap from a technical perspective. So I don't have a use for a high-end statistical package, but I do have – sometimes I do come up with scenarios, things that I observe that are just too complex to do with Excel. And for that, I rely on the actual charting package and the capabilities of the built into the charting package itself.
Okay, sure. Now, that's a great answer. That definitely explains it. And I mean, it's good to know that you can do so many things with Excel. I mean, I'm a bit of a novice with Excel, but it's good to know that it has the scope and the capability to do these sort of things. So,
do you trade it on a do you day trade it, or do you trade it on a position basis?
I'm not a day trader, no. So I'm more of a swing trader. I could get into a position and hold it for, you know, a few days to a few weeks if it goes well. But in saying that, I could be out the same day if it goes sour. So
yeah.
Yeah.
So in that, with that approach, like if I was trading in that method, I would want to know, for example, what is the range, per day, to expect in Goldman? What is the range per week? How much of the week have I covered? For example, if I put on a Monday position and it's going for me and it's already covered 99% of the range, the average range, and it's Thursday. Maybe I shouldn't wait till Friday to close that position. You know, maybe I'm pushing it to get that extra 1% if it gets there. That sort of simple. Then that stuff is very easy to pick up, right? Right out of a chart. You know, you just need to look at a weekly bar and look at its range and just put it on a spreadsheet. Okay, for this week and that week and that week, this is the range, and so on average, I get this much range on a weekly basis. And since my time frame is about a week, this is how much range I should expect on my next trade. So I shouldn't be pushing for, you know, a $6 move in Goldman Sachs when I don't hold over the weekend. You shouldn't be pushing for $6 move when the most common move is about $4. I should be looking for an area to exit around $4. That's an edge.
Okay. No, that's really good. I appreciate you going into depth on this. That's really good. All right, well, let's just do a couple more questions. I mean, we're pushing just over an hour now, so we'll do a couple more questions, and then we'll start to wrap this up. So, I mean, you mentioned earlier on that you originally started out as an equities trader and a couple years later made the switch to trading futures. So for anyone listening to this who may be interested in doing the same, what are perhaps some of the greatest differences that they should be cautious of?
With regards to switching to futures?
Yeah, from equities.
Okay, so once I switched to futures, I never looked back at equities. And for several reasons. One, extremely efficient use of capital. I don't have to – the notional value of one S&P contract right now is approximately $100,000. It's trading around the 2,000-point range, and it's worth $50 a point for the S&P Mini. So it's a $100,000 notional value. I don't have to put up $100,000 to hold a trade. And some brokerages, and I disagree with this, you only need $500 to hold that much buying power. So I don't need that much capital. When I started my trading business for myself, my prop shop, I started with $25,000. And I got a rate of return monthly. And this may seem really nonsense to you, but the monthly rate of return was between 65 and 85% per month. That only exists because of leverage. Now, that's the upside. Let's talk about the risk. If you're trading a $100,000 product for $500 in an account, it takes very little to wipe out your account. So you have to, with futures, you can't mess around with risk. I think stocks are a little bit more forgiving. But at the same time, I don't like about stocks that they can be they can make their move on their own based on one factor alone. I'll give you an example. You're long Goldman Sachs and something happens. You find out that they're being sued by the U.S. government or something, and this lawsuit's going to cost them billions of dollars. And you had your stop just below yesterday's low. And you come in and you see that it's trading at 50% of yesterday's price, closing price, way below your stop. And guess what? That's where you're going to get filled on your stop. There's no liquidity there that's going to fill your stop at market where you set it. And it's because some actions is taking place or some news events taking place in that one stock. That doesn't happen in futures. If you were trading a liquid product, you can't have one company controlling what the S&P 500 is going to do as a commodity. It's representing 500 stocks, and so there's plenty of liquidity, and it's much more methodical. Futures, however, are more competitive. It's a level playing field. There are no surprises there, so it's. To extract money, you take advantage of the fact that you have this leverage to make money. So there's positives and negatives. One of the key positives to futures is that I don't have to deal with this day trading pattern rule. I don't have to deal with that. I don't have to have a $25,000 account to buy and sell and buy and sell and buy and sell futures hundreds of times in a day and come back and do it again and again and again tomorrow. All I need is $5,000, $10,000 or whatever, and I'm able to trade as much as I want. And then whatever profits I make are taxed in the U.S. On a long-term as well as a short-term basis. So the tax liability by trading a commodity is much, much better. My taxes are much lower and my costs are much lower when trading futures than when I was trading equities. Equities, I had liquidity provider versus liquidity taker fees. I had, you know, routing fees. I had all kinds of fees. It was very expensive to trade the one stock, and I still had to put up, even with margin being offered by my broker, like 4-to-1 margin being offered by my broker, I still had to put up with fees, and I had to pay interest on that margin and incur penalties on that margin. That doesn't exist in futures. I feel like futures are just a lot cleaner. However, futures are more difficult to learn on because the leverage creates a much higher emotional response in people. You can trade a 10-share lot while you're learning. You can trade a 10-share lot in equities. Pick an equity and just trade 10-share lots in it. You can't do that in futures. You're either going to play with the big boys or you're not. There's no way. The lowest amount of quantity of trading you can do is one contract, and that one contract may be worth $100,000 or $50,000. There's nothing smaller than that. So it kind of freaks people out. The ideal situation is you start out, if you're trading equities, switch over to trading, say, spiders or some other ETF and trade small and put together a good number of days, put together a good expectancy or a good edge, see that you have a positive return, and then make the switch to futures. Do it with a broker that helps you watch your risk or provides you the tools that help you watch your risk, which is really why I got into the brokerage business, is to create that environment. But any, you know, most brokers will be able to help you with that.
Okay. And just to add on to this, I mean, one thing I often hear about aspiring futures traders or people say about aspiring futures traders is that they're often undercapitalized. So in that case, I mean, what would be the ideal amount of starting capital a trader should obtain before possibly going into futures markets?
So I think whether it's you're going into futures or equities, it's likely to be the same. You know, the thing I always recommended, and it seemed like not many could do it, is the minimum amount you should be trading is really $25,000. That's a minimum amount. That gives you the ability to make mistakes, and your loss should be based on what your account value is. So with $25,000, you should be able to get many, 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 many samples of trades under your belt and still have, you know, $12,000, $10,000 left once you've figured it out. What most people do is they come in with $5,000, you know, some brokerages take $2,000. That doesn't give you any room for error. And believe it or not, just like learning to ride a bicycle or learning to walk, you're going to fall. There's no way to avoid that. So stop being afraid that somehow you're going to lose money. You're guaranteed to lose money. It's part of the process. You cannot exhale without inhaling. An arrow cannot move forward without being pulled back. This is the same. You're going to have to lose money to learn because it's part of the learning process. And so if you're going to lose money to learn, then you want to minimize the risk and you want to have as much capital as possible to allow you to take the losses. It's just part of your tuition. And still have enough remaining to continue to practice and be in the business. So to me, $25,000 is the absolute minimum, and you should expect to probably lose at least half of that. And I'm saying this with a very strong statement. Losing half of it means you are a disciplined trader controlling your risk, and you will still lose half of it probably based on my experience. And that is okay, because when things get going on a futures contract with the leverage, making that $12,500 or $13,000 or $15,000 back is not that uncommon in a very short period of time. When I made the turn, once I hit $1,000 on a day, putting up $400, $500 on a day was fairly straightforward. And all I had to do then, and this is what I did, the main reason my prop shop was successful is because I was an absolute Nazi about risk losses, about risk control and daily losses. I made a commitment to myself that if I exceed a daily loss or a loss limit on a trade, that I have to sit out the next day, which is painful because you expect to make money every day. And so even with controlled losses, you know, controlled risk, you're going to experience losses. Just accept that this is part of the process. Most people come in and they think, I'll put up $5,000 in an interactive broker's account, and I expect to make a return of, you know, 300% a year. Good luck with that. That's not realistic. The reality is it'll take a long time, because the key element, we didn't talk about this much here, the key element of the entire process of trading is your psychology. Is your level of awareness of yourself? Is your level of honesty with yourself about who you are and what your nature is? And most of the losses, and take this from a guy who's turned traders around and made them profitable for myself, for my own prop shop, most of the cost of my operation in turning a trader around was invested. I would say 80% of the losses that a trader took when they're learning was the cost of them adjusting their behavior. It's not about, oh man, I'm losing money, so I better learn a new indicator. I'm losing money, so I better get on this forum and find out what this guy is doing. Oh, I don't have a good enough charting system. Oh, I need a more powerful computer. None of that's going to help you. Most traders, after the first few months of studying technical analysis, studying fundamental analysis, if that's what they want to do, you know enough technically. It's not the technical end of things that is turning you around that's causing the problem. The problem is behavior modification. Is your ability to do what's right, even though emotionally and instinctively you want to do the opposite. A market's running up. What do most traders want to do? They want to see it get weak, and I want to sell it. Well, maybe it's running up for a reason, and selling into a run-up is just a pause before it continues to run up. Your instinct is not to buy it after it's run up. Your instinct is to sell it after it's run up. But selling it after it's run up has a low probability in most cases. Things like that. Stopping yourself from getting emotional is a key one. Being aware that you're angry, that you are afraid. Just, it doesn't mean you can, I'm never going to tell you to control your emotions. It's a very, very hard thing to do. But your losses and the amount that you're investing, the capital that you're risking, the overwhelming majority of it will be spent on you, on the time it takes you and the experience it takes you, the cost of the experience it takes you to change the way you behave and to accept who you are as a person. You know, look, I get emotional about losing. I don't like losing. I hate losing, so I fight. I continue to fight and fight and fight and fight, even though I'm clearly out of sync with the market. That's not a good plan, and that'll cost you 20% of your account before you stop me. For some people, I've watched people melt 80% of their account away before they stop, before they realize, oh my God, this isn't working. That's a very expensive way. to learn. If you're going to lose 80% of your account, do it on 3,000 trades because you're picking something up on every trade. But if you start with $2,000 or $5,000, how many trading samples are you going to get? How many experiences or notches under your belt are you going to get before your mind starts getting the concept or you start to internalize the concept of what it takes to make money? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. No, great answer. Another great answer. So, yeah, very good. Let's just run through one last question and then we'll wrap this up. And this one came through on Twitter. It was from Alexander. And he's asking, what's the importance of giving back and leaving a legacy? So I think you've got something interesting to share on this. So keen to hear your thoughts.
So a question came up during one of the interviews as I was recruiting a trader into my prop shop. And it was a college grad, and he said, you know, I know I could be good at this, but why do people do this? Like, what's the point? It seems kind of selfish what we do as traders. You know, you're just going there and you're clicking, and it's very capitalistic and it's very self-serving. We're just after the money. What's the purpose? Well, the purpose of trading, your purpose as a trader, is something you need to believe in and be aware of. Your purpose as a trader is to create an orderly market. The idea that day traders exaggerate moves or create volatility is absolutely false. My participation in the market allows much, much bigger traders, bigger institutions, to have more prices for them to get in and out of the market. So I serve the market in that sense. Much like a car dealer exists for the purpose of taking cars out of factories, holding them in his or her lot, and helping people have a selection and buy a car and enjoy the inventory that he has. We traders have inventory. Every time we have an open position, we're holding inventory. And if I didn't exist, then imagine a factory making a car and trying to sell it directly to the consumer. It would be very difficult to do that. It would be much more expensive. And so there's that service that we provide. Imagine the spread that would exist in Goldman Sachs if traders were not in there. You would have, you know, multiple price levels. You'd have multiple ticks that are blank because there's nobody there willing to fill those in, and that's what we do as traders. So on a day-to-day basis, I know that I'm dampening the market's volatility by taking the risk in the inventory from those who want to sell or those who want to buy and holding it for a period of time, and I get paid for that risk. That's my purpose. I help regulate the cost of, you know, I'm just a little drop in the bucket, but I still help regulate the cost of crude oil or cotton or whatever it is that I'm trading. But the end result of what I'm doing is I've got a big trading account. Great. I live off of my trading account. I can buy nice things with it. But your legacy has to outlast the material purpose of your existence. As a trader, I control my time. I control where I trade, when I trade. It's one of the beautiful things about this business. If I do that for myself, then I'm really not serving the a purpose for a greater society. And so it's important to give something back. It's important to help others. If it weren't for that friend in a meditation retreat who took me in and showed me the basics, I would still be grinding away working in a construction firm somewhere. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but I've lived a much better life now than I did when I was doing that. He took the time to do that. It's my obligation to do the same. This is why I share openly what I do on Twitter. I have, I think, almost 24,000 or 25,000 followers on there. This is why I have so many videos on my website. This is why I've created a Stage 5 Trading. It's because if I help someone else achieve the independence or achieve their goal of wanting to have better control of their life, then that person is going to feel obligated at some point to give back to their community. This is why I run a charity. It's another way of giving back. I have the ability, and I'm lucky enough to be able to do that, to control my time, volunteer, and so on. So that's what I do, because ultimately, even if I were the greatest futures trader in the world, who cares? Who cares? Ultimately, my legacy is in my children. My legacy is in how I helped others achieve their goal. In the end, it's a small blue planet. It's a very tiny place that we live in. It's a tiny little dot in the galaxy. If I help other people achieve their goals, then it's just human nature. There's no way that they're not going to do that and pass it on. And in one way or another, I get to benefit from it. Not to mention the fact that when I started backing people and training people, I went from being an okay trader who made money. I think my first year at the prop shop, I made like $300,000. And that was okay. But once I started to back people and really pour my heart into their success, as opposed to just giving them a trading account, giving them a trading platform and saying, make me money. No, I would pour my heart into them. I would make sure that they are successful before I hired the next guy. And that's a huge part of my success as a prop shop. Once I started to do that, I started to really learn the business. I started to really learn how I react, why we do the things we do when we don't follow our rules. I started to really understand the ins and outs of what it takes to trade by helping others. So having had that experience on directly made it clear to me that I have to continue to give. And I love this business. I love trading. It's a passion. It's not a job. It's not work. It's not painful. It's something that I'll do all day, every day if I could. So if I can go and talk about it, if I can provide something, if I can help someone out, if I can do an intervention like I've done many times, someone who's struggling and is about to give up, if I can do an intervention and look at their statistics and look at their performance and say, here's what you need to focus on, get back to me once you've done 50 trades this way, there something lights up in them. And when something lights up and they see some success, they have an obligation, a human obligation to do that for someone else, be it their brother, their friend, their cousin, some stranger on Twitter, or whatever. What you're doing, Aaron, with these chats with traders is you're creating a legacy. You're creating a legacy for other traders, and you're improving the legacy of each one of your guests, including myself, by creating a recorded record, a recorded archive of what we're doing, right? You're serving me. I'm serving you. We're both serving other traders. It's a small community, and I'm driven to continue to do what I can within limits. As I get older, I'm 43 years old. You know, that's why it's Futures Trader 71. I'm 43 years old. My time is becoming more and more valuable. So my time is focused more and more on just building that legacy, more so than building wealth or whatever, you know. So this is a very important topic, and I think ultimately all traders have the obligation to do something that helps the greater good. That's the whole purpose of money. It's not to hoard. It's not to throw it in, you know, six Porsches and a big mansion. That's meaningless when you're dying. What's important is what have you done with your money to improve the flow of prosperity in the community that you're in or around the world, as you and I are trying to do.
Very, very good answer. Well said. So thank you very much for going into such great depth with that answer. And big thanks to Alexander for asking that question too. Obviously led to a very great answer. So, all right, FT, well, we should probably wind this down now. So before you go, do you want to share with listeners where they can go to find out more about you?
The best way to get a hold of me is really on Twitter, FutureTrader71. My website's FutureTrader71.com. If you want to be involved in the day-to-day participation and help and context and all that stuff that I do for our brokerage clients, our traders within our brokerage, then check out Stage5Trading.com. I'm not a broker. I don't sell things. I'm not interested in selling you on anything, but I do look at everyone that joins there as almost like a prop guy. And I do what I can to make sure that, that they stay in the business, that they continue to do this passion, to follow this passion. So FutureTrader71.com. FutureTrader71 on Twitter or Stage5Trading.com. Those are the best places to get a hold of me. You can always contact me through those any one of those venues.
Excellent. Good one. And I'll make sure to put those links in the show notes as well so anyone can visit them through any means. But this has been phenomenal. So thank you so much for giving up your time today. I mean, it went for a little bit longer than we expected to, but I don't think anyone's complaining. So thank you very much for doing this.
Thanks for having me on. It's an honor.
No trouble. Take care, and let's talk soon.
Take care. Bye.
You've come to the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but don't worry, more great episodes are on the way. To stay updated with each great new episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you leave us a rating and review. We'll see you next time on Chat with Traders.